Hello everyone, hope you all are doing very well. This is, I think, the first podcast which is entirely in English. You can let me know if it worked, because if it works fine, then maybe I can record more podcasts in English and or maybe in the combination of both Hindi and English. This will help those to get access to the podcast who are not very well versed with Hindi. So please do let me know the feedback of this podcast. Also, please do consider supporting me on Patreon, buy me a coffee or PayPal if you like this podcast. This podcast has been so far being run by incredible support of many listeners. I need more listeners who can contribute and keep this podcast going. Also, one quick update, people who are living in India cannot pay me through PayPal because Indian government launched a new rule. So only those who are living outside India can pay through PayPal. So Indians can donate through InstaMojo, which is the substitute of the PayPal. So all the links are mentioned in the description box. Welcome to Anurag Minus Verma podcast. This is podcast number 32, and today we have Rajesh Rajamani with us. Rajesh is a prominent anti-caste voice who, through his work and writing, critically analyzes Savarna gaze in Indian art and cinema. He is a film critic who writes for many prominent publications. His essay titled The Dharavi Story in Tamil Cinema, How Kala Inverts the Nikon Gaze. Kala is a film by Paranjit and Nikon is a film by Maniratnam, for my viewers I'm saying, won the Red Ink Award. Last year, his brilliant short film The Discreet Charm of Savarna was released, which reverses the gaze towards the Savarna and makes a satirical commentary about their privilege upper caste gaze. We will talk about this film as well in detail in the podcast. I'll also put the link of the film in the comment section so that you can watch the film if you haven't already. So Rajesh, first of all, welcome to Anurag Minus Verma podcast.
Thanks Anurag, thanks a lot. I've been following your work and thanks for inviting me to the podcast.
So Rajesh, can you talk about your background? Where are you from? Where have you studied? And when did you get fascinated by cinema?
My dad was in a transferable job and I studied, most of the time we studied in different cities in Tamil Nadu. And I think about my later part of my schooling and my engineering, I did it in Chennai. And then I did my management from IIM Indore. Then I was in a banking job for almost 5 to 6 years before I decided to quit and come to, do full-time filmmaking. But films have been always fascinated. I think from, say, 5 or 6 years old, I've always been fascinated with films and I've always wanted to be a filmmaker. But I think, coming from a very middle-class family, there's a certain, my parents have a certain demand, you have to study, do engineering, do an MBA, get a job. But I think once all that happened, I think it became easy to quit everything and start from scratch.
But did you join any film school or professionally studied?
No, I didn't actually. So actually, after I quit my job, I was considering going to film school. But then I actually realized that, making your own short film is much more, much more educative than actually going to film school. So I decided, okay, let's make our own short film and see whether it's going to work or not. If it turns out all right, I thought I'll continue with filmmaking. If it, it turns out very bad, then I think I thought, I could go back to banking. That was the idea. But of course, once we started it, it's very difficult to go back to, the regular 9 to 7 job. So, yeah.
So when did you get this idea of making your first short film? Like when was the film Discreet Charm of Savarna, the idea of it came to your mind?
So what happened is, after I quit, my banking job and I was trying to make films, I had moved to Bangalore because I had some friends from the film industry there and I knew some actors there. So I thought I could, work from out of Bangalore and make a film there. But I didn't know, I didn't have an idea initially, but only thing I was very particular is at that point of time, say this was in 2017-18, at that point of time, I think everybody was making a film on first dates. All short films were either about the first date, which is a coffee date, or the breakup, which is also happens in the coffee shop. So I was just so, I hated it so much that I said, I'm not going to make a movie on romance and it will not be in a coffee shop, So then I think I was looking at, anything which is interesting to me, but not about romance or coffee dates or breakups and all that stuff. Then what happened is one of the days, I think I came across this, a casting advertisement from one of those very popular Mumbai-based casting group in Facebook, where they are actually looking for, the advertisement say that we are looking for actors who look like Dalits. So obviously, there's a lot of criticism and uproar about it. I mean, I found it very bizarre. I found the idea, I mean, obviously, it's a very bizarre thing, but I just forgot it for a while. And suddenly, you know, I was watching some other film a couple of days later, and I saw some, I think it was some European film where I saw a bunch of three characters. You know, there were two men and one woman running to catch a train. And suddenly it struck me, why can't these three characters be running across a city to find an actor who looks like Dalit? You know, I just thought, why can't I combine this moment from this film I was watching and that advertisement? I thought if I mix this, it'll be a very dramatic story. So then I got very curious. Once this idea came in, it became very interesting for me to put it in paper and write it as a script. And then eventually I was able to flesh it out.
Interesting. But this advertisement that they want somebody who looked like Dalit, was it in Chennai or in Mumbai for Mumbai film industry?
So this was a Bombay-based group. You know, this was a very Bollywood group where they wanted. I mean, they took it down immediately. They took it down after a lot of criticism happened. But it is one of those viral things which goes for a week. You know, so yeah.
So how many years did it take for you to, you know, start the film and then release it? So what was the duration of this whole process?
So once we started, you know, writing took me a couple of months, you know, like because, you know, I had an idea. Then I thought I wanted to make it more dramatic. So we were wondering which city to put the story in, you know, that took a while to decide. Then I thought Bombay is the best place to, you know, locate the story, you know, because I worked in Bombay and I sort of understand Bombay to some extent. And Bombay also has a very strong Ambedkarite politics, you know. So I thought the irony would be even more stronger if I place a story in Bombay. But it took me a while to write down the story. But then it was also easy to find the actors to some extent, because I think I used to write a comic called Inedible India, where, you know, I used to use this, you know, Ravi Verma's paintings or Kaligat paintings and make those characters have a conversation on some socio-political issue, you know. So I think I networked with a lot of people who were interested in following the comics, you know, some of the actors who I reached out already had followed Inedible India and they knew me. So it was sort of easy to convince actors to get it. And but what happened is, because we were also very ignorant about filmmaking, I think we were just too brave and we just went to shoot. Once we shot it, then it became a very long process to do the post-production. Because, you know, that's something I wasn't aware of. And, you know, the process of editing, dubbing, you know, sound and color, all that actually we had to do once and then we didn't do it well. So we had to redo it. So that took a long time. That actually, you know, the post-production took almost 1.5 years. But the writing and the shooting, we're done in 3 to 4 months.
It's interesting. That point was very interesting that you were saying that is a strong culture of Ambedkarite politics in Mumbai. But still, there is a caste ignorance. And especially in the film industry, because I have also met many, you know, producers and many even actors who are totally ignorant about how the caste system work or how the caste society functions. So that brings me to this question, that what are your thoughts about anti-caste films that are made in Tamil or South Indian film industry as compared to films that are made in Mumbai film industry? This also includes films made by quote-unquote independent filmmakers. So do you think films from South are more conscious and aware about caste and social issues as compared to the Mumbai ones?
That's certainly true, because if you look at Tamil Nadu, even before, the advent of filmmakers like Ranjit or Mari Selvaraj or, you know, others, what has happened is, I think because of the Dravidian movement, you know, the Dravidian movement also has produced anti-caste films. You know, I think even in the, say, 1940s and 1950s, we have had films like, Velekari. We have films like, that's a Parasakti. You know, these are very important films which critiqued Hindu religion, which critiqued the caste and the class system. You know, so we have had the history of, very socio-political themes which critique the caste. But I think what happened is, I think this sort of tradition existed maybe till 60s and 70s, I would say. And after that, I think, Tamil cinema sort of changed. We started making very caste pride oriented films, landed communities and upper caste, you know, they started making films which was about their caste pride. But I think after the 90s, it's when, the Dalit movement and Ambedkarite movement sort of became stronger in Tamil Nadu, and I think what we see today is a result of the consolidation of the Ambedkarite movement in politics is reflected in art forms as well, and that's why we see filmmakers like Ranjit Mari Selvaraj today. But I think, of course, but you look at say Bollywood doesn't necessarily have any history like this, except in Maharashtra you might find anti-caste strong Ambedkarite movement, but still in some way Bollywood and Bombay is sort of pretends to be insular to that, and Bollywood doesn't inherit any specific anti-caste politics. The only politics that Bollywood inherits is the nationalist politics, which is why Bollywood keeps producing films about Kashmir, about Pakistan, about it's often about India's sort of insecurity about its borders. I think that's what Bollywood, because that's the politics that Bollywood has inherited, and that's what it can reflect. So we often have about problems in Northeast or films. Even now we have like the series film Family Man was about the Sri Lankan issue. So these are all very nationalistic projects where they capture the insecurity of the average Indian Hindu nationalist. That's what. Or the other thing that Bollywood produces is sports cinema, because sports also, even though most of these sportsmen tend to be, apart from cricket, most of them tend to be Bahujan men and women, but still sports in some way caters to a certain nationalist fantasy and dream, so I think that's what Bollywood produces. So Bollywood anti-caste films, Bollywood cannot produce anti-caste films in my opinion, because it has to inherit a politics to reflect it. There is no such politics for Bollywood to inherit, so whatever it makes, it's going to be some sort of a commodified product. That's the best that Bollywood, I think, can produce.
Yeah, I think some of the recent films are example of the same. But what you said about anxiety about the national borders, I think you have explained it very well in your essay that you wrote about Maniratnam, where you critically analyzed his film and politics. Even I think you also analyzed the Kala in an article that Kala by Paranjit is a deliberate rewriting of Maniratnam's Naikan from a Dalit Bahujan perspective. Right. So this analysis of Maniratnam is very different from normally how Indian critics view Maniratnam, which is some sort of a godly figure, and aura around him. So my question is, what is your overall assessment about filmmaking of Maniratnam?
The thing is, when you live in Tamil Nadu and you love cinema, it's very nobody can escape Maniratnam films. You grow up watching Maniratnam films, and he's certainly in terms of as his filmmaking style is certainly very interesting, and I think his visuals and his music, how he combines them, there was certainly a freshness in how he makes his films. So it's very easy to be anybody to be drawn to his films, and there is always a human emotional angle. But I think so even when I was growing up in school days, college days, I was a huge fan of Maniratnam, and I think, to be honest, even today I'm sort of I love the way he makes, how he combines visuals and music. That's something I'm still in awe of. But I think I started identifying my own politics, so then it was possible for me to look at through an Ambedkarite Periyarist politics when I was looking at Maniratnam's films. Then I suddenly realized, oh my god, like this person I was fan of all my growing up years, his politics is very very Brahminical, hyper-nationalist politics. So that's something I used to write on and off on social media. But, and I thought, but what happened is, whenever Maniratnam, even the criticism that's on Maniratnam often seemed very scattered. People might write about Roja, people might write about Dilse, but I thought it was very important to put together all his films together, look at all his entire filmography, and see how there is a certain, a typical Brahminist, hyper-nationalist vision that is very consistently seen in his films. And I thought it's important to holistically look at his filmography. And I think the essay that I wrote was an effort in it. Also, another thing you look at, in terms of, you talked about critics often going gaga about Maniratnam. There's a certain, if you look at the English critical, film criticism space, that is itself is a very Brahmin dominated space, or Brahmin or a Savarna dominated space. You either find You know, often it's a very strange thing, but you often find a lot of Nayars and Menons writing on cinema, or generally about art and culture in general, and particularly cinema. Or you have, you know, Mukherjee's strategies from Bengal writing about it. You know, either it's Kerala or it's Bengal, or the next one would be Tamil Brahmins writing from Chennai, you know. And these are the most people who write on cinema. So obviously what happens is that the Malayali, the Nayars and Menons keep saying how Malayalam is, Malayalam cinema is the greatest in the country. And the Bengali critics keep saying why the Bengal cinema is the greatest, which is why I think these critics, I think, have been doing PR for the last 50, 60 years and making us all believe that Bengal cinema and Kerala cinema are the most, you know, progressive and contemporary and modern and all that. But the truth is, I think almost there have been a lot of interesting cinema happening in other states, particularly in, you know, Andhra Pradesh, in Tamil Nadu. But I think there are not enough people to write about these films, you know. And I think particularly if you look at Tamil Nadu, because of the Dravidian movement and since the 70s and 80s, there have been a lot of OBC filmmakers, you know. Particularly, there was one important filmmaker called Bharathi Raja. He started capturing lives from rural Tamil Nadu, and mostly it represented OBC lives. But I wouldn't say OBC lives, but it's a very broad Baujan life. But his characters might be centered around his own community, which is an OBC caste. But I think once that happened, I think the success of Bharathi Raja as a filmmaker brought a lot more OBC filmmakers into the industry. So if you look at today, in Tamil Nadu, there are, you know, there are quite some, you know, Baujan, you know, OBC filmmakers or even Dalit filmmakers. But you look at film criticism, it's still controlled by Brahmins and Savarnas. You don't have a proportionate amount of Baujan writers writing on cinema. So what happens is, the only ones who write, often they keep going back to Maniratnam and Kamal Haasan, and they keep praising them and saying why Maniratnam is great, why Kamal is great. So Maniratnam hasn't made a good movie in more than 10 years or even like 15 years, but still they're stuck upon him. You know, they keep writing about him, yes, again and again today. Or they keep writing about Kamal Haasan. And Kamal Haasan also, to be honest, the last 10 plus years, I think, after 2000s, his films have not been so interesting. But still, they keep writing about it. But I mentioned about Bharathi Raja, right? Somebody like Bharathi Raja, or somebody like Balu Mahendra, or somebody like Mahendran. These are very important filmmakers in Tamil. But if you Google them, you'll hardly find any analytical piece on their work. You know, there'll be very little work written on them in English. You know, that's because there are not enough Baujan writers writing on cinema. You know, I think that so we only the English Indian market only gets to know about Maniratnam and Kamal Haasan. So my idea was also to sort of provide a certain Baujan perspective, you know, like since they're always praising Maniratnam, but because these Brahmin and Savarna film critics are never going to critique Maniratnam critically, you know. So I thought it's important, like it's only a Baujan writer can bring in that sort of perspective, you know. And I thought, since I'm writing in English, I thought it would be interesting to capture that.
No, it's very interesting. Because I always thought there must be some caste connection to it. The way he's hyped, even many of my Tamil Brahmin friends, they look at Maniratnam. I mean, it's not a relationship just because of the art. There is a lot more than art which is going on there. One question came to my mind when you were speaking, that what is the reception of Paranjit's films in Tamil Nadu by Savarna critics? And
so I think so. His first film was a very, you know, if you see, his first film was called Attakatti, which is a very small film, and he's also a beginner, you know. So I think a few people appreciated it, but I think it was not really talked about, his first film Attakatti. But I think his second film Madras was sort of well received, you know. It was sort of, because I think the politics was still very subtle in Madras. It wasn't, he even in his interviews, he was being very generic, you know. He wasn't so articulate and open as he is today. So I think people didn't really understand the film, but it was appreciated. But I think after Madras, once he signed Kabali and Kala, then he became very articulate. He became very open about his Ambedkarite anti-caste politics. And I think Kabali and Kala received a lot of, criticism, very harsh criticism, because I think there was also a certain jealousy in seeing Ranjit working with Rajinikanth, you know, because working with Rajinikanth is the biggest thing to happen to any filmmaker. So there was a very surprise and shock that the industry felt, and there was quite very harsh criticism on both his Kala and Kabali. But I think now that he made Sarpatta, I think the particularly the Brahmin Savarna film critics, or everybody, even the people who were otherwise very harshly critiquing, I think they have decided to make peace with Ranjit, because they realize, I think they have now realized that this man is going to stay here for a while, you know, so we might as well make peace with it. So I think they have decided to sort of make peace with him, like after Sarpatta, I think.
What are your views about film criticism quality in India? I think you can't produce good filmmakers when you don't have good quality of film critics who can sometimes see through the bullshit of popular notion about any film and also analyze the film from social, cultural, and even from aesthetics of filmmaking, and also from view of intersection of many different art forms. So do you think this is one of the problem with film criticism in India, which is extremely superficial and doesn't help any viewer or even a filmmaker to understand their own craft?
Right. That's very true. I think it's again, because I think it's sad, because you look at media houses, you know, media houses are the ones with, you know, the whether it's a print or the digital media house, they're the ones with resources to commission, you know, film writing, you know, but again, you know, if you look at these media houses, they're again populated primarily by Brahmin Savarnas, the employees, the journalists, the writers, they're all primarily Brahmin Savarnas. So we often have to deal with your perspective. So one thing that's one huge problem you see with the digital and the print media is that, like say 20 years back or even 25 years back in the 90s particularly, film critics used to take a lot of time to write cinema, because cinema used to exist, you know, it used to last in a theater for a longer time. It used to last for 50 days and 100 days. So I think a film critic can take a couple of weeks to reflect on a film and write about it. I think what has happened particularly right now is because social media is much faster in reacting to cinema, you know, because you have so many people, you know, it's sort of the film writing has a lot more democratized today. You know, everybody who watches a film is almost a film critic, and you know and people are writing, and sometimes very common people come up with very interesting opinions and interesting perspectives and insights about cinema. So I think the film critics who are working in the digital and print media, I think they are in a very desperate mode today, I think, you know, which is why I think, you know, you look at media houses, either they come up with very superficial opinions on the same Friday the film releases, or sometimes, you know, you look at, say, when, you know, a Paranjit film or a Mari Selvaraj film releases, you know, all media houses are after Bahujan writers, you know, because they think that, you know, because they are not able to offer interesting insights on these films, you'll find all Bahujan writers or, you know, kidnapped and made to write on these films immediately. But if you look at it, when it comes to writing on gender, still Brahmin Savarnas hold it, you know, like they don't give that to, you know, anything on gender issues. If the film is touching upon gender things, they will not give it to Bahujan writers. Only if it's about caste, they'll give it to Bahujan writers. But otherwise, it's mostly with the Savarna writers. But I think the biggest problem with these writers is that they're unable to, it's like, I think their understanding and their reading is very limited from their own socio identity, you know. And I think they're only able to look at films from their own Brahmin or Savarna perspective. And I think that limits their understanding of films. As a result of it, even the audience are not able to see very diverse perspectives to read. You know, they're unable to read diverse perspectives on films. And I think, but again, these media houses are going to continue only employ Brahmin Savarna. So I don't know how you know, how that can change. But what I think is interesting happening is the increasing presence of, you know, Bahujan writers on social media, you know, whether they're making YouTube channels or whether they are writing on social, Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, you find a lot of Bahujan writers now writing on their own. You know, they're not paid, but because they love writing about cinema, they're doing it. And I think that sort of has democratized, you know, film writing. And because once somebody writes and it's, people like it, and I think they, a lot of people follow them, and that sort of creates you know, opportunities for such writers. So I think social media, in my opinion, has democratized film writing to a large extent.
I'm very curious to know that, what is your assessment of filmmaking being practiced in Mumbai at the moment, especially when there are many new mediums, new platforms like Prime and Netflix, and so many platforms which are trying to give voice to, I think, new filmmakers. At least they claim to do that. So do you think any different kind of content is coming out because of the technology, or we are still stuck somewhere?
Well, I think I'll look at two things here. Like, one, you asked about the OTT, the proliferation of the OTT is one thing, and another is Bombay. One thing is, I think Bollywood can never make interesting films, you know, because Bollywood, see, Bollywood doesn't have an history, okay? See, Bollywood is based on, it's based in Bombay as a location, but it is not telling the stories of Mumbaikers, you know? It is not telling the stories of the residents of Bombay. It's trying to tell an imaginary Indian story, you know? And this Indian story, there's no common Indian story at all, you know? There is no, like you can never tell a story which is common to a Tamil like me and somebody in Assam or somebody in Rajasthan. There's no story which sort of, we are culturally, you know, very different. And, you know, Bollywood wants to sell films to Rajasthan, Assam and Tamil Nadu, you know. So I think Bollywood does not have any history. It does not even have a location. It's like to tell stories, the stories have to be rooted to a particular land, you know. It has to be located, it has to be rooted to a geography. And sort of understand their culture and the lives of those people, and then reflect that in cinema. But Bollywood is not rooted in any specific location. It has a broad India as an imaginary thing, which is why Bollywood either produces films, like I said earlier, you know, it produces films on the Indian Army, the Navy, fighting with Pakistan, terrorism, or it wants to make films on sports. Or the other thing is, we saw, at one point of time, a lot of NRI films. Because again, NRIs don't live in India. Again, there is no geography that's attached. So, you know, you can easily make a very generic NRI family wearing colorful clothes and dancing to Bhangra in US. And so what Bollywood does is, Bollywood doesn't have a land to tell a story. And it's always going to be superficial. And I think that's always going to be the state of Bollywood, because that's how it is structured. But where we can actually tell real stories is, it's a regional cinema which can actually tell the real stories of people and the real stories of Bahujans in particular. You know, with all the shortcomings of the regional cinema, I think Telugu, Malayalam, Marathi, Tamil cinema will be much suited, much more democratized and much more able to tell the stories of Bahujans, you know. So I think that's always going to be a contradiction between Bollywood and the regional cinema. Regional cinema will tell the real stories of people, number one. And the other thing you asked about the OTTs. So I think OTTs in some way have strengthened the power of these Brahmin Savarnas, is what I would say. Because it's a regional cinema and the theatre structure which actually had democratized cinema, like particularly in Tamil Nadu, I would say. It's a theater system which has, because it's the theater, the average person going to the theater is not the elite population, you know. In Tamil Nadu particularly, like place like Tamil Nadu, is the average Bahujan male is the theater goer, you know. So because it's most of these working class men who are coming to cinema to watch in theaters, the films are also made for them, you know. The films are made to touch upon their lives, to entertain them. So the films are also made to entertain the average Bahujan man, you know. I mean, of course, there are films which touch upon, you know, which are made for family, which are made for children and all that. But primarily, the theatre caters to a Bahujan, male population, you know. So it forces it to, because that's where the money comes from. So producers and distributors are forced to tell stories which cater to that segment. But what happens in OTT is, OTT is telling stories to a very elite segment. It is actually, you know, the consumers of OTTs are primarily, you know, metro-based, Brahmin Savarna men and women, you know. So the stories which are packaged for them is sort of told to their sensibilities, you know. So if you see even village stories, rural-based stories that are released in Netflix or Prime, they'll always be about somebody returning from the US and going to meet his grandfather or grandmother in a village. Or it'll be like he'll move from Delhi to go to a village, because it has to be told through the perspective of a elite metro-based upper caste person, you know. So OTTs will be that, you know. I think OTTs are never going to make films for the Bahujan. It might tell Bahujan stories, but it is not making films for the Bahujans to watch. It's primarily, even if it's Bahujan stories, even if it's anti-caste stories, whatever these OTTs claim to produce, they are essentially making it for a very elite Brahmin Savarna audience, which I think is sort of doing the reverse of what the theater system did. The theater system, with all its drawbacks, was able to democratize cinema to some extent. I think it's all this is being reversed by OTTs, particularly the big ones, I think.
Yes, I think also because the people who greenlight the project are themselves extremely elite and have the whole Savarna sensibility. So they are completely not connected with the reality. So whatever they produce have their own sensibility. So it's like we are fed upon Bendra upper class sensibility, I would say. So we are on the mercy of them.
Very true. See, if you look at, for example, say Prime and Netflix, the kind of the series they have been producing for Tamil, they've been, it's very, either they make romantic stories, they make some, very elite people romantic stories, or they make, whenever it touches upon, say, there was something called Pavakadigal, which a bunch of Tamil filmmakers came together to make for Netflix. And I think it was actually centered around honor killing, So now honor killing has become a commodity, So if the elite consumer wants to feel shocked about the Indian society, they can go to Netflix and watch Pavakadigal, which will be about the family trying to kill the daughter or the son, or it's a bunch of honor killing stories, and people can comfortably sit in their in the comfort of their homes and watch these shocking honor killing stories, so it's like reducing the stories of Baujans to merely honor killing, just very violent shock value products are produced. So I think we're gonna have much worse happening if the theaters don't open.
But do you also think that this whole the anti-caste films will also be made as a commodity in future, or maybe is happening right now, where the Savarna have realized that there is ongoing discourse and they can cash on it?
That's certainly true. Today it's become very, I think particularly after the death of Rohit Vemmala, there has been an increased discussion on caste, in social media, in mainstream media, and everywhere actually. So I think anti-caste politics has always already been commoditized through a lot of ways, not just cinema, in terms of you just see social media, it's like everybody is angry, and like you don't know whether who's a Baujan, who's a Savarna, who's a Brahmin. Everybody is angry and outraging, it's so confusing, who's who, and I think that sort of this wasn't this case say 5 years or 6 years back, like everybody's cover picture is Savitri, everybody's cover picture is Ambedkar. So it's very difficult to understand whose politics is what, So that's already happened because it's become a cool thing to do, so which everybody is doing. But I think I'm sure anti-caste films also will be commoditized. It's already commoditized. It'll have. But I think what I think is all commodities don't last forever. They are often they're fashionable only for a while. And I'm sure the market finds something new after some time. The market is not going to just be anti-caste politics is not going to be the only fashionable thing. I'm sure they'll find something else. It'll be environment or climate change or mental health. I'm sure the market will find newer cool things to talk about. But what I think is, once it becomes out of fashion, Baujan filmmakers can still come back and make meaningful cinema. But I think maybe for a while we're going to have this commodification. I think.
But how can film industry be diversified where we can have more Bahujan voices who can tell their own stories? I think in Mumbai, Neeraj Gavan tried to do it by releasing a call where he said that he wants a DP assistant director, and he was badly attacked for this call by his fellow directors. But still, it's not something which one filmmaker can do, which Neeraj can do. It's a systematic thing. There needs to be some systematic change in industry which can assure diversity. So what are your thoughts about it, and do you think it is possible in near future?
I think that's more possible in regional cinema than Bollywood. See, in Bollywood, Neeraj Gaivan, however he tries, he made his film for Dharma Productions, And I think the minimum that he can do is he can try to, bring in Baujan voices within his team, for that particular project, you know. And I think, and even for that small effort, he was so harshly critiqued, you know. So you know, it sort of endangers his own position also, you know. It's the sort of you know, the criticism that sort of thrown at him. But I think I think these democratization is much more possible in regional cinema, which is already happening. You already find you know, a lot more, like in Tamil Nadu, I said, we already have so many Bajan film, like, you know, OBC filmmakers making films, you know. There are even Dalit filmmakers doing it. See, but I think what is more important is to create a sort of, it cannot happen when Dalit or Bajan filmmakers or individual people, you know, unless they create a sort of a film community, you know, sort of a movement, you know, it only when a sort of a movement is created, then it can be an inspirational call for a lot more people to come in and join, which in some way is happening in Tamil Nadu, I would say, because you look at the success of Paranjit, you know, after working with Rajinikanth, you know, I think the success, at least, you know, even though it was critically, you know, it was, you know, harshly critiqued, you know, Kala and Kabali, I think it made a lot of money, you know, the films made a lot of money. And I think that allowed Ranjit to sort of start his own production house, and he's producing films, and that sort of is allowing a lot more Bajan filmmakers to come and make their first film, you know. So as I know, Neelam Productions is making almost like 5 to 6 films with different Bajan filmmakers, you know. And I think, and all of them are not just Bajan filmmakers, but they're also very politicized filmmakers who have strong opinions on, you know, anti-caste politics, or, you know, or on class. They're all well read, you know. They're all, you know, inclined towards Ambedkar politics or Periyar politics or Marxist philosophy. So I think, you know, very very politicized filmmakers are happening because of the success of one person like Ranjit. Commercial success of one person like Ranjit is allowing for, you know, for a dozen more younger filmmakers to come in. And I think if these filmmakers also then allow for another dozen filmmakers under each one of them, I think that'll be a growing sort of pyramid where you'll have a lot more, you know, very politicized filmmakers coming and making it. But again, I think this is more possible only in regional cinema. Bollywood, it's far from it. See, look at say, even, you know, when they remade, Nagaraj Manjule's film, you know, they remade it, and they sort of diluted the politics of it. You know, that's what Bollywood can do. You know, Bollywood can never have the, you know, the honesty or the intensity, or the accuracy of the politics that regional cinema can, you know, can so, you know, bravely tell.
Even one can't imagine any superstar working in anti-caste film or film which deals with these issues
in Bollywood. Yes, exactly.
But it's very interesting, like Paranjit means this collaboration of Paranjit with Rajinikanth. So normally, any superstar doesn't come to a filmmaker when he hasn't made any big blockbuster film or something like that. So how this collaboration came in, and especially when he's making a film which deals with the themes of anti-caste, how did this collaboration came in?
I think that's also, in my opinion, I think that's also very very shrewd choice by Rajinikanth, actually. Mm. Because I think what I remember reading about is, I think Rajinikanth watched Ranjit's, you know, Madras, the film called Madras, and I think he liked it very much. Hmm. And I think Rajinikanth's films were also failing at the box office. You know, I think his film Kochadayan and his film Rana were like utter flops in the theater. So Rajinikanth's career was almost trying to get over, you know, because he has been like, you know, his films became extremely boring and they've been box office duds. And I think Rajinikanth was desperate to reinvent himself. So in some way, I think Rajinikanth wanted the, you know, the grounded and the fierceness of somebody like Paranjit to revive his career. So I think that's why he chose Ranjit. And I think if you look at Rajinikanth's films before Kabali, Rajinikanth was still trying to play a very young character. You know, he started looking like a clone of himself. You know, he started looking young and he was wearing wigs which were not suiting. He was trying to dye his hair. Rajinikanth was like, you know, was sort of was trying desperately to connect with his old audience, but failing at it. But I think I think Rajinikanth was forced to work with younger filmmakers to revive his career. And I think he had a couple of choices, and I think Ranjit was one of the choice, and it just worked out. I think the script came in place, and I think it worked out for them. But you actually see Kala and Kabali actually revived Rajinikanth's career. People thought Rajinikanth's career was over with the previous film before Kabali. Yes, it's called it's not called Rana. I forgot the name now. I think, but it's a complete dud of film. But I think Kala and Kabali have brought his market back, and I think now Rajinikanth is acting in bigger films again in commercial entertainers, and I think he sort of got his market back. So I think it was a very shrewd attempt by Rajinikanth to work with Ranjit.
So I'll take few audience questions. There are two audience questions. So one is by Naji Pod Host. He wrote, Rajamani sir wrote a brilliant article called "The Right Wing Hindu Hyper-Nationalist Politics of Mani Ratnam's Film." Please do read up and bring that article up. Also ask about the blatant display of Brahminical point of view in mainstream Tamil films, like director Shankar's film, for example. The movie Aparichit or Aniyan in Tamil is a massive blockbuster, but incredibly casteist. Most characters of Balachandra, Mani Ratnam, Shankar movies are Brahmin. Also ask him about the Shinghanians of Iyer, Iyengar and Brahmins in Tamil society. Positive discussion would include wonderful movies like Sarapatta and Parallel Cinema. The social reality of Tamil Nadu is an endless conversation, sir. Please be a window to Tamil Nadu itself through this episode for your mostly North Indian listener.
I think if you look at Tamil cinemas, you know, if you call something like Brahmin cinema, I think Balachandar would be the father of Tamil Brahmin cinema. You know, he sort of normalized the Brahmin stories, and you know that it's like the Brahmin who is actually only 3% of the Tamil population. To Balachandar's movies, I think the Brahmin became the common man. It's very similar to R.K. Lakshman's Common Man. You know, it's like the Brahmin, like in terms of population, they are a very small percentage. But it's very amusing how in the cartoons, it's a Brahmin man who's shown as a common man. You know, ideally the common man should be a Bhaujan man, right? The Bhaujan is the majority in India, in country. And I think, but it's very strange that the Brahmin man is the common man. I think in some way, I think Balachandar did the same thing. With his films, you know, the Brahmin characters became representative of Tamils, even though they were only 3-4% of the population. I think that sort of continued to very modern, contemporary, nationalistic, politics in Mani Ratnam's films. Shankar films are, in fact, even more scarier films, because what Shankar does is, in Balachandar and Mani Ratnam, at least, you know, there is a certain subtlety, you know, they try to propagate a certain Brahmin politics, but in much, they mix it with human emotion and relationship stories and, drama and all that. You know, there's a certain, it's much more subtle. But I think in Shankar's films, the Brahmin politics is almost like the very, very militant right-wing type. You know, it's almost like an RSS militant variety. You know, it's much more of dangerous variant. But I think it's very sad that Shankar has been still able to capture the imagination of the average Tamil audience, you know, because he's also been packaging his films as very blockbuster entertainers. This militant Brahmin politics has sort of been at least till the last 5 years. People were buying it without any criticism, but I think because of social media and a lot of Bhaujan writers writing it recent times, I think the last 5 years, I think people have been heavily critiquing Shankar's films. So I mean, I'm very curious to know, because even the films like Indian, Shankar is making the second version of a film called Indian, which is again a very militant, nationalistic film. So it'll be very curious to see how it's gonna come, because earlier he was not critiqued. But now he's making a film of the same theme after a lot of criticism that's happened, among the public. So it'll be very curious to see how that's going to turn out.
So this is the final question. It's by Suzu Sano. So he writes, Rajesh has criticized the Savarna gaze in Indian film frequently. Has any director managed to represent the struggle lives of ordinary OBC or marginalized character according to him? Any Savarna film director, to be specific. Also for upcoming filmmaker who want to represent the lives of marginalized group even after being an upper caste individual, is it wrong to do so? And if not, how can we do it correctly without journalizing? I think it's an Interesting question. That can you create good art or good cinema without having a lived experience of it? So I think that is the basic question.
I think technically you look at it, all art form in some ways universal. You know, like, you know, it's like we watch something, we read something that's written by a Japanese writer, we watch a Russian film and we feel moved. Technically, art is supposed to be, you know, make us all feel united. You know, it's supposed to make us all connected in the world. You know, even though we have different cultures, you know, we have different, family system, lives and society, everything is different. But I think art in some way is supposed to, technically, it's supposed to make us feel as one, you know. And I think the achieving that universality is what art should ideally strive for. But unfortunately, that's not what is happening. You know, art is here, you know, in cinema here, it's sort of used for the very specific pandering politics, you know. But I think if filmmakers want to do it, I'm sure they can do it. Because sometimes we watch some Italian films and we feel moved. And it's made by some white man. And if we can feel moved by a film made by a white man, we can, I think even Savannah filmmakers can do justice. But I think they should bring in a certain honesty, they should also work hard to understand the lives of the stories that they're trying to tell, you know. And I think if they do that, I'm sure it's possible.
Also, I think there is a clash of privilege. Like when you are a Savarna and you are writing something about anti-caste or anything, then there is always a clash of privilege which many people don't want to acknowledge or don't want to challenge it a lot. So this might be the reason why the product is not authentic and it comes off mostly as a savior thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think they have to be extremely honest and extremely perceptive of, you know, their own role, you know, the kind of stories they tell. But what I'm trying to say is it's not impossible. It's certainly possible if that particular filmmaker or writer is bringing in that sort of honesty. Today, people, when Dr. Gail Omved passed away, you know, so many Baujans wrote about her, right? Like wrote about her, you know, there's so much affectionate, very, you know, tributes written about her, and she's not a Baujan woman, you know. But I think, but she's been able to bring in a certain honesty and empathy through her work, and I think that's what has touched so many Baujan lives, you know. If Dr. Gail Omved can do it, I'm sure some other filmmaker can also do it. You know, it's just that they should bring the kind of empathy and honesty that somebody like, you know, Gail Omved had been able to bring in, you know. And I think if they can bring in, it's I think it's possible.
So thank you so much, Rajesh. Really enjoyed this conversation. We hope to see your new film and read your new wonderful articles in future. Thank you so much for coming to the podcast and sharing your insight with us.
Thanks a lot, Anurag. I think it's been very fun conversing with you, and thanks for inviting me. Thanks again.